Are you ready for a whole new way of being in the world? Welcome to Living from the Inside Out with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is meditation without meditating. And the numbers to call to get coaching on having what you want and thriving, or just to talk further about this whole notion of what it is to meditate without meditating. 866-254-1579. Toll free in the United States and Canada. Outside of the US and Canada, you can dial 001-760-918-4300. And as always, I will set the table. I occasionally invite people to dinner as well. I mostly just set the table, it seems, in the show. But I'm going to set the table by talking about what I mean by this idea of meditation without meditating. So it's a phrase, if you listen to the show regularly, you've probably heard me say before. It was actually the working title for the Hay House program that became The Path of Effortless Change. And the reason that I like it as a title, the reason that I like it as a subject area, is because built into it is a distinction that I think, in my experience as a former meditator, wasn't part of my meditation training, which was a distinction between the process of meditation, the doing of meditation, and the state of meditation, the place of meditation, the quiet mind and beautiful feeling that meditators tend to meditate in search of or in aid of. In other words, what everybody wants is the state of meditation, is that experience of a quiet mind and a beautiful feeling of spirit, of source, of self before our conditioning, of our true nature. That's why we meditate. But the obsession, the focus, the books, the teachings, the courses are invariably around the methods, the how do I get to that place? Or sometimes they're so disconnected from the result that it's just like, oh, don't worry about the result. The results, that's a very Western way of thinking. It's just about doing it. Yeah, but for the sake of what? Because. Oh, okay. Now, I'll put my caveats in up front. If you are somebody who a particular meditation practice has been a lifesaver for you, has been a boon for you, has just changed your life, please do not mishear me as saying, you must stop it. You shouldn't do it. Ha ha ha. I'm simply raising a distinction that I have seen in my work, that I have experienced in my life, that many of my clients and students have experienced for themselves, which is the thing that changed your life wasn't the practice. It was what the practice opened you up to. It was where it took you. It is the space that it allows you to access in yourself. It is the perspective on thought and on your thinking that it allows you to have. It is that sense of expansion, of going beyond the word, before thought, into a place of pure presence. That is healing. That state of meditation does it for everybody. Now, what's kind of cool about meditation without meditating, about living in a space of meditation without having to formally meditate to get there every time, is that you can actually experience that state of mind, that state of being in all things. You can meditate while playing music, right? That's what, you know, when musicians talk about being in the groove, they're in a state of pure meditation, sometimes ecstatic meditation. In dance, you know, dancers will say that when they're really caught up in the dance, nobody's leading, nobody's following. It's just, there's no separation between the two partners. That is a state of pure meditation. That's why sometimes music has been reverse engineered to try and become a meditation. Dance has been used as a meditation. But it's because those states often appear when we are engaged, when we're fully engaged in what we're doing. There's no room for extraneous thought, and we experience that deeper place beyond thought, that space of meditation. Sometimes people will be in that space of meditation while they're out for a walk, when they're driving. Athletes can be in the middle of a competitive sporting event and be in a state of meditation. And the reason that meditation doesn't have to be reserved for the pillow, it doesn't have to be reserved for the meditation hour, for the morning ritual, for the evening ritual, is because it is our natural state of being. I have a snow globe on my, on my bookshelves. I'm looking at it going, what is that that it's sitting on? And it's it was a gift from a client, and it's a crystal Buddha inside a snow globe. Now, in its natural state, in its resting state, it is clear. I can see straight through to the crystal Buddha. The light illuminates the Buddha, and that's as it is. When I shake it up, then the Buddha is obscured. The light gets blocked by the snow, and it seems like I've got to do something to get back to the Buddha nature of the snow globe. The Buddha at the center of the globe. But actually, I don't need to do anything. And in fact, anything I do to try to quiet the snow globe makes the snow globe noisier. Other than putting it down and leaving it be. And then the snow naturally settles, and that which has always been there at the center of the snow globe is revealed. Now, it's a metaphor. Okay, we're not snow globes. The mind isn't a snow globe, but it's like a snow globe in the sense that it's designed not to always be still, but to always return to stillness. Not to always be clear, but to always return to clarity. That's its nature. That's what it's for. And sometimes it's even more beautiful when you shake it up than when you let it sit. Right? Another metaphor that I will often use for thought is going to the movies. Right? When you go to the movies, you know what you're seeing isn't real, but you go to get lost in the illusion. You go hoping that you'll be swept away in the illusion, that you'll forget that it isn't real long enough for it to make you cry or to scare you or to make you laugh. Or to uplift your spirits. That's why we go to the movies. We don't go because we don't want them to exist. We don't go to the movies to get rid of the movie and sit in the empty theater with the projector not projecting anything but light onto the screen. That's not the point of a movie theater. I'm not convinced the point of a mind is to always be still. I think the mind is a great illusion generator, and we live in the greatest illusion of all, the great illusion of life, the dream of life. Sid Banks said, life is a divine dream suspended between the boundaries of time, space, and matter. So here's the thing. You don't have to be in a state of meditation. You don't have to always be experiencing clarity, peace, stillness. But you can at any time, no matter where you are, no matter who you're with, no matter what's going on around you, no matter what you're doing, because it's natural. We can learn to meditate, but we don't have to learn the space of meditation. And nearly everyone I know, and this was true of me when I started meditating, there's a sense of familiarity when you touch that space. I've actually heard the voice in my head say on a couple of occasions, oh, this space. I know this space. It's recognizable to us, although we may not have given it any significance. We may have thought, oh yeah, that's nice. One of the funny things that happens, so I train transformative coaches. So I train coaches in the art of working with this understanding that I talk about each week in the show, this inside-out understanding with clients to help them experience more freedom and more possibility and more creativity and more aliveness in their lives and in their work. And one of the things that is inevitable in this conversation are people drop into the space of meditation. Meditation bubbles up inside them and they get quiet, sometimes quieter than they've been for a very long time. Even though it's just a conversation, there's no, okay, we shall now meditate to it. But both the clients and the coaches, when they're new to it, tend to quickly talk over that and go, yes, anyways, let's find the next thing to talk about. Because they don't recognize that space for what it is. It feels like a lull in the conversation. I remember in the play The Seagull by Chekhov, there was a whenever there was an awkward silence, there would be the doctor, I think it was, would say, a quiet angel just flew past. Well, quiet angels are flying past all the time. But we don't notice them because we value the noise more than the quiet. We value the content more than the context. We value the content of our thinking more than the fact that we can think anything. We value the content of our experience and miss out on the glory that we are able to experience anything. We latch on to the form of an idea instead of marveling at our capacity to ideate, to create, to imagine, to see things in our mind's eye that have never existed in the world. So we're like these absolutely amazing creative beings who spend so much of our time trying to convince ourselves that we're amazing. I am a good person. I am a good person. I am a good person. I am wise. I am wise. I am wise. Yeah, you are. Like, you really are. But that's revealed in the quiet. That's revealed in the silence. That's revealed when you stop. And there's something else that's still there. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these movies, but it was quite common in film noir where somebody would be walking down the street. It wasn't always a woman. It could be a woman or a man late at night. And they'd stop suddenly because they thought they heard footsteps. And then the second or third time they stop, they definitely hear the footsteps because the footsteps don't stop when they do. Now, in a noir movie, that's usually bad news. But in life, it's good news. We are constantly being stalked by God. Right? We are constantly just a few steps ahead of the state of meditation. And if we stop for a minute, it'll catch up to us and it will overwhelm us. But we don't get that's what's chasing us. So we keep running. We keep moving. We keep talking. We don't see that what we're looking for is invariably in the silence. What we're looking for is in the good feeling. What we're looking for is presence. It's present. Like, there's a reason that the power of now and be here now and all these books about the present and now have been really popular for, oh, I don't know, a few thousand years. And it's because this is it. Like, this is the whole thing. And in any given now, anything can be experienced. And being in a space of meditation, being in a state of meditation, doesn't preclude you experiencing it. It doesn't mean, well, when I'm in a state of meditation, I cannot feel this and I cannot feel that. No, you can feel everything arise inside that space. Meditation is vast. It contains multitudes. It is the space in which it's easy to see. And it's easy to see all of it. It's easy to see all the crap in our thinking. And it's easy to see all the beauty in our thinking. And it's easy to see the Buddha at the center of the snow globe. The enlightened being that is no different in you than it is in me. That is no different in me than it is in Buddha. That is no different in the Buddha than it was in Jesus. That is no different in Jesus than it was in the soul of anyone. It's just that something different happens when you wake up to it. And when we hang out in that space of meditation, that's like a mini awakening. It's a mini satori. It's a moment of pure being, of pure presence. And our days are filled with those moments. We just don't notice. One of my favorite Winston Churchill quotes is that most men stumble across the truth from time to time, and then they get up, dust themselves off, and carry on as if nothing happened. Well, we all stumble into the space of meditation from time to time. We all stumble into the quiet underneath the noise, into the silence within which everything is audible, into the stillness within which movement is clearly observable. But most of us stand up, brush ourselves off, and carry on as if nothing happened. And so my hope for you during the show, and if you want to talk, we can talk. Numbers to call, 866-254-1579. Toll free in the United States and Canada, outside the U.S. and Canada, 001-760-918-4300. It's really good to know that all the benefits of meditation are available to you whether you meditate or not. So, what are the benefits of meditation? I'm so glad you asked. I'm not even going to begin. I'm sort of almost embarrassed to talk about this on a network that is filled with people who've been studying meditation and teaching meditation as long as they have, in terms of trying to accurately reflect the benefits. But benefits that I know about, all sorts of health benefits. Why would there be health benefits to meditating? Well, there's a few reasons. One is the body does really well when it's bathed in love. Right? Our cells do really well when they're bathed in good feeling. When the happy chemicals are running amok. But also because the number one cause, some doctors say the only cause of illness, mental or physical, is chronic stress. So if you've looked into epigenetics at all, you know that certainly one of the theories that has a lot of evidence behind it is that under chronic stress, which is stress that goes on for more than, I can't remember, the number is insanely low. I think, if I'm remembering my why zebras don't get ulcers correctly, the human system is designed to operate under stress for up to 30 minutes every 48 to 72 hours without any long-term effect. So if you're only experiencing up to 30 minutes of stress every 2 or 3 days, you're working perfectly. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't meet many people, myself included, who experience that little stress in their lives. Well, the state of meditation is the opposite of stress. the state of meditation is inherently peaceful, full of peace. Mindful, full of the universal mind, the deeper mind, the intelligence and aliveness behind life. So when we are in a state of meditation, we are not in a state of stress. So if the state of meditation is a quiet mind and a beautiful feeling, well, then stress would be a noisy mind and an icky feeling. Well, kind of makes sense. When you're in a quiet mind and a beautiful feeling, you're not in a noisy mind and an icky feeling. So on the one hand, if you spend most of your time in a noisy mind with a horrible feeling, you probably just feel relief when you drop into the space of meditation. Like, oh, I get a break. But it's even better than that, because the mechanism whereby stress creates illness is the triggering of certain genetic tendencies. And when the stress is gone, the system comes back online. The self-protecting mechanism of the mind and body don't need to protect you anymore. And so your natural health bubbles back up to the surface. Your natural sanity and clarity of mind reappears, and you're as good as new. And there are so many studies that show that even people who were suffering the depths of schizophrenia, who come back to complete health, no remnants of their illness, even stories of people with autism who become fully functioning, not highly functioning autistic people, but fully functioning human beings. That's part of the potential of hanging out in the space of meditation. If we knew, if that was all we knew, like if that was all we got about this was, no, it's really good for your mind and body. Well, that would be cool. That would be worth our time. That would be worth paying attention to when it's present. That would be worth understanding at a deeper level. But it's more than that. It's also the seat of creativity. It's where your next great idea is going to come from. It's going to come from the state of meditation. It's going to come from the space of meditation. It's going to come from nothing. No thing. The space before form. The space of meditation. Okay, so I get it's good for my mind, it's good for my body, it's good for my business and my career. But why else would I want to meditate? Well, it feels amazing. Being in a state of meditation feels amazing. I talk about it sometimes. I did a podcast. I think it was this week's Caffeine for the Soul podcast. You can check it out at michaelneal.org, where I talked about being functionally stoned. Now, you may not be a stoner, and I certainly am not a stoner, but I did my time. I went to school. And there's something about living in a state of meditation that's kind of like being a little bit stoned, but functional, right? You're able to go around. You're able to operate in the world. You're just a little high. But you're high on your own endorphins. You're high on your own being, your own well-being. The well of your being, the knowledge that all is well. And so it's kind of fun. Everything becomes a little bit lighter, a little bit more amusing, a little bit less heavy, less, oh God, I've got to go do that. Heaviness comes from how much thinking we tend to have in our heads that all looks important and real. How much snow is accumulating inside our snow globe? Well, when the snow settles, the light comes in, and there is a lightness. There is a lightness to our being. And that's kind of cool. That's kind of awesome. Now, here's the thing. If you just hear the benefits and you think, well, okay, the way to get the benefits is to meditate, you're going to go looking for a meditation practice. And that's fine. Unless you don't want one, have tried one and failed 30,000 times, or feel beholden to it, almost like a superstition, like, well, if I stop meditating, it's all going to fall apart. These are the benefits of the space of meditation. And one of the ways, the most common way that people know to access that space is through meditating. And all I'm doing in this episode is pointing to a possibility that you can experience all of the same benefits without having to do the practice. Now, I'm going to come back to that because I don't want it to seem like, well, we're all in it anyway, so no need to do anything. And, rah, 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 and if you don't understand that this is in you, if you don't look to it, you probably won't see it. You'll have moments, but they'll be few and far between. So maybe it's disingenuous for me to say meditation without meditating, because no, it's really helpful to listen for quiet. It can be really helpful to, when the space comes up in you, to sit in it, to marinate in it, to let it fill you up. But it's not a terribly formal process. It's just kind of the obvious place to look if you know how much beauty is in that direction. Let's go up to Oregon and let's speak with Fawn. Fawn, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Sorry, I had to pull you off my headset.
That's okay.
I was wondering if you can give me your thoughts or some insight on using meditation to help with cervical spinal stenosis. I've been playing around with some stuff, with visualization, just kind of like trying to go in and opening, right?
Yeah.
Because it's narrowing.
So here's... I'm sort of like going, let me give 5 minutes of qualifying statements and then a 30-second answer, but I won't do that. I'll do the short qualifying statement, which is obviously I'm not a medical professional.
Absolutely.
And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to get that out. Now, here's the thing about the space of meditation. It's like a warm bath of God. So it's good for whatever ails you, but it's not a targeted thing.
Right.
Right? Like you don't get in a bath and think, I only want this to help my spine.
Absolutely.
So it will help simply because it is just great for the body to soak in love.
Okay.
And it's great for the body, for the mind to not be in chronic stress. Right? So those two things alone are just going to be good for everything that ails you. Now, the one extra bit is, as you are in that space, one of the qualities of that space of meditation is the inspired idea, the inspired action, the insight. And so it's not at all uncommon to sit in the quiet where you're, maybe for one of the few times, you're not thinking about it. You're not kind of going, okay, what can I do today to alleviate that? You're actually just resting in peace.
Gotcha.
And from that space, ironically, that's where the best ideas about what we could do to actually help ourselves with our issues come.
Okay.
And it may be visualizations like the ones you're doing. It may be things that are completely different. But it's one of these things that's, to my mind, all upside, no downside. Worst case, you bathe every cell in your body in health and love and God. Best case, it also helps alleviate a specific condition.
Understood. Thank you so much.
A pleasure, Fawn. Thank you. And that's again the difference between meditation as a state of being and as a practice. Is it's not for anything. I've shared some of the benefits that come from it. But because you're not doing it, you're not doing it for an outcome. Now, people will tell you in meditation practice, I was taught in meditation practice, don't do it for an outcome, just focus on the form. But that's even more true with this. It's like the snow globe is not still for a purpose. It's not still so that it's easier to see the Buddha inside. It's not clear so that I can see through it. It's clear because that's its nature. The Buddha is inside because the Buddha is inside. The snow is settled because that's where the snow sits, except for when it's being shaken up. That's its nature. And that is our nature. Our nature is clear. Our nature is still. Our nature is Buddha. Our nature is present. And when we see who we're not, which is all the noisy ideas we have about who we are and what we should be and what we should be doing and what we are doing, and you probably know that without my going into too much more detail. When we're not doing that, when we're not caught up in that, in trying to be a better person who does better things and thinks better thoughts and feels better feelings, then we can look and see who we are. See, most of us, most people I talk with, when they go to know themselves, they don't get very far before they start having an opinion about what they're seeing. So, I think I'm going to know myself. I'm going to take a look and see who I am. Oh, God, I do this. Oh, God, I do that. And we immediately either are so horrified by what we see that we stop looking, or we're horrified by what we see and we step in and try to change it, not knowing that all we've seen is the snow. All we're seeing is the output of the system. All we're seeing is the effect of all the conditioned thinking that we're living in, unaware that we're living in it. We're trying to fix the effects of a movie that's just a movie. Right? If somebody is devastated by a movie, which happens, right? That's the joy of movies. That's part of the magic of the movies. You don't actually have to fix it. You just have to remind them that it was just a movie. And when they see that, they settle back down really quickly. Right? Somebody's had a dream, right? My wife, I mean, I've used this example and it keeps happening, right? I know it's not just us. You know, we had a funny conversation this morning because we had a fight in her dream. And it was not based on a true story, but we had to kind of work through that. But we only had to work through it a little because she did know it was a dream. She did know that what happens in our dreams aren't necessarily anything to do with real life. And we have all sorts of theories about, oh, no, it is. Well, it can be. One of the more interesting studies I remember from when I used to work at the Mystic Trader bookshop in London and kind of was managing this just font of New Age ideas was that the most of dream dictionaries became massively more effective once you'd read the dictionary. So in other words, it was almost like once you read the dictionary, it taught your brain a language to dream in so that it could communicate with you. That did not mean it was trying to communicate with you all along. I mean, it sometimes can be. But most dreams are just noise. They're just the the light that spins off from the brain spinning. One of my favorite, and I like dreams. I like dream interpretations. I'll share my favorite dream interpretations. So here are the three. So two of them came from Hawaiian shamanism. And one was from, they were both, actually. I think I learned originally from Serge Gehili King. My favorite of his books was called Urban Shaman. I haven't read it in years and years and years. I have no idea what I would think about it. But at the time, I loved that book. I read it again and again and again. And he would talk about dreams as that if you had a dream and you wanted to get a deeper understanding, you would go back into the dream while awake. So you'd go back into the dream and you would simply ask everything in the dream, hey, why are you here? Hey, giant hammerhead shark trying to eat me, what do you represent? And then the hammerhead shark says what it says and you dialogue with it. You can literally go up to, hey, tissue box on my desk, what are you symbolic of? Oh, well, I'm symbolic of the fear of sadness. Oh, neat. And we can have these great, fun experiences in our own mind. But it doesn't mean that we have to get caught up in the dream. All right, second one, from Serge Gehili King, was if after you've dialogued with your dream, you want to go back into it and see where it goes next. So you continue the dream. And that's often interesting, where the dream goes from wherever it stopped to wherever you stopped remembering it. But I think my favorite dream interpretation system, my favorite dream interpretation thing, is a theory, and it's a theory. I'm not saying this is true. I like the theory, and it's fun to play with dreams in this way, is that the feelings in a dream are what the feelings that are going on in you, maybe outside of your conscious awareness. So if you feel angry in a dream, it's because you're feeling angry. If you're feeling sad in a dream, it's because you're feeling sad. If you feel happy in a dream, it's because you're feeling happy. But literally, none of the symbology means anything. It's just your brain dreaming in its own language. And that's why if you teach the brain the language of a dream dictionary, you begin to dream in that symbology. But generally speaking, it's pretty random what we dream. Now, what's the point of all this when it relates to the state of meditation? Well, it's pretty random what we think. But unlike our nighttime dreams, which most of us get aren't real, we take our daytime thinking, our daytime dreams, much more seriously. We think we need to take what we think to heart. And as best I can tell, nothing could be further from the truth. We think, and we can think anything, which means we do. And sometimes we'll think something that is helpful to us. But a lot of the time, we just think. Right? You can go into the snow globe, just to kind of ride that analogy all the way. Right? You can go into the snow globe and you can start identifying, these snowflakes have this shape and these snowflakes have that shape. So that must mean, and I couldn't dispute that. I can't tell you if snowflakes have meanings. But I can tell you that if you get really caught up in the snowflakes, you won't see the Buddha. And when we get really caught up in the content of our thinking, whatever that thinking seems to be about, we don't see the space inside which thoughts come and go. Pure consciousness, uncontaminated by our personal thinking, which is another way of talking about meditation. And we also don't see the Buddha at the center. We don't see the universal intelligence, the infinite intelligence, the infinite creative potential at our core. And that's another gift of living in this state of meditation, of hanging out more of the time in this place of quiet, in this place of stillness. Not doing anything on the outside. But what various spiritual teachers have talked about as doing without doing, or being not the doer. There will be activity. The fear that almost everybody I know who starts down a meditation route has at some point is, if I just hang out in a quiet mind and a beautiful feeling all the time, I'll never do anything. I just sit around all day. Well, no, that's not meditation. That's depression. That's where you're actively bogged down by so much thinking that it's impossible to get the energy together to do anything. There is such a lightness to meditation. There's a depth, but it's a light depth. And while it may, what you do may change. You may do some different things. You may not be drawn to all the same things. It doesn't preclude you doing anything. This, I don't know if this is controversial or not, but I know for a fact people meditate during war. And not just formally meditate between battle. If you listen to, if you read descriptions from soldiers of battle, along with the horrors, there are moments of pure aliveness that get described. Moments of deep, deep connection with our fellow human beings that are revealed. There is no place you can be where meditation can't. Because meditation is our nature. And the extent to which we experience that is the extent to which we're interested in it. If you start to really get interested in this inner quiet, I promise you, you'll start experiencing more of it. If you start to get interested in who you really are underneath all your ideas of who you are and who you should be, you'll start to see more about it. I remember one of my favorite descriptions for meditation is the great undoing. Because all our conditioning, all our conditioned thought, all our ideas of who and what we are and who and what the world is dissolve, unravel in that space of pure quiet, pure stillness, pure presence. And sometimes that's wonderful, because a lot of our self-concept is really horrible. Sometimes it's a little distressing, because there might be bits of our self-concept we really like. But when we are willing to become undone, what we truly are is revealed. I was listening before the show, and they were playing a clip of my friend Robert Holden. And he was not in that clip, but one of my favorite things that I've ever heard Robert say is, he has a prayer, and I might mangle this a little bit, but he says, "Dear God, please help me see the truth of who I am, no matter how wonderful it turns out to be." See, we don't want to look too closely at ourselves because we think we already know. Yeah, I don't want to go there. And no. I may seem nice on the surface, but I know if I started looking deep down, I'd see all this crap. Well, you might. But if you kept looking, underneath all that crap, you'd find a pony. Underneath all that snow, there's a crystal Buddha. Underneath all that noise, there's a deep and profound quiet. That's the space of meditation. That's our true nature. I remember once reading a book on meditation, and it talked about it in terms of peeling an onion. And you've probably heard that metaphor. It's a very common metaphor. That it's like peeling away. You peel away at the levels of personality and the levels of thought. And for whatever reason, I was probably, 18, 19 years old, and I was living in London. And I stopped at a greengrocer and bought an onion. And I went to the park. It was a beautiful sunny day. And I just started peeling the onion. And I remember I got to the center of the onion, only to realize there is no center to an onion. Like, at least the onion I had, when I peeled everything away, there was nothing left. And I had this moment of kind of despair, like of utter horror that there was nothing there. And then the universe opened up. And suddenly, because there was no longer an onion to hold my attention, I became aware of the whole park, the whole city, the whole planet, the whole universe. When there is no thing present, nothing present, we become present to everything, to the source of everything, to the space within which everything arises. To me, that's the kindness of the design. We're not only made of this, we're made to see it. We're made with the capacity to know ourselves. There's a T.S. Eliot poem called The Four Quartets. And the bit that I quote most often is from, I believe it's from part of the poem called Little Gidding. And he says, "We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Well, that's the invitation of meditation. To arrive where we started, to go back to basics, to go back to source, to go back to who we were before we thought anything, before we were taught anything, and know the place for the first time, and recognize it for what it is, and connect the dots. And we start to see, oh, I've been in and out of this place my whole life. But because there was so long between visits, I didn't recognize it for what it was. I didn't recognize it as home. I didn't recognize, oh, it's the same place. What a thought that is, that you have spent moments of your life in the same space as the Buddha, in the same space as whoever your heroes of enlightenment are. Now, maybe they spend more time there than you do. Maybe they experience it at an even deeper level than you have. Maybe there is more of a purity to their experience of it, and yours is a little bit more dilute. But that's kind of the promise of enlightenment, is it's our natural state. It's a waking up to the fact that we were never really asleep. It always seemed quite disconcerting to me as a young meditator and spiritual athlete, in the sense that I was always trying to be better at being spiritual and perform better and be more spiritual, that enlightenment was both talked about as a happy accident, not something you could do, but also was inevitably talked about as the moment that someone realized they didn't exist. So in that sense, no one becomes enlightened, because enlightenment is a description of the experiencing of no self, of no one, or of all one, of all being one, of no separate self. So no one becomes enlightened, because enlightenment is this description of seeing that there was never anyone there. Now, that may be too esoteric for where you're at. That may be really cool for where you're at. That may seem meaningful, or that may seem really conceptual and intellectual. My favorite description of enlightenment, maybe because it's the most hopeful, or maybe because it's the one that has the resonance of truth for me, is that we're all already enlightened. We just don't know it. Now, here's why that makes sense to me. Because we are all already whoever we really are. And if meditation is our nature, stillness is our nature, quiet is our nature, as opposed to, oh, I'm naturally shy. Oh, I'm naturally outgoing. Oh, I'm naturally good at business. Oh, I'm naturally bad at sport. Our true nature is deeper than all of that. And if meditation is our true nature, there's nothing we can do or not do that's going to make that more or less true. It's just that there are some things that make it easier to notice, and other things that make it harder to notice. There are things that obscure and things that reveal. But that which is obscured or revealed can't be impacted. Like if you take a statue and put a bunch of towels over it, or like a big tarp over it, you can obscure the shape of the statue, but the statue's still there. If I put 23 veils on top of a light, it might be dark, but it's not that the light has been diminished in any way or went away. And as I remove each veil, it's not that the light actually gets brighter. It's just that the light, which was always already there, becomes easier and easier to see and begins to illuminate everything around it. And that's the final gift of meditation, is that as we let our light shine, as we let the veils of thought be stripped away through the great undoing, through hanging out in this space of pure presence, it's not that our light gets any brighter, but it begins to be more visible. People become drawn to it. And it begins to illuminate the world around us. So if this kind of conversation is interesting to you, if you go to michaelneal.org in our inner circle, we've got a new video series on meditation. You can also at Hay House find The Path of Effortless Change, which even though we changed the title, still has a lot more about this. And I think you just enjoy the, I'm trying to pick one, but the books of Sid Banks, I don't often recommend them because they're an acquired taste, but there's a book called The Missing Link, and it's very simple, but it's one of those things that's simply profound, and I've been reading and rereading that book on and off for the last 11 years. And while there definitely have been times where I've gone, I'm not seeing anything in here, more than pretty much any other book, it takes me back to this space each time I read. So, I hope you enjoyed the show. You can always learn more at michaelneal.org. Until next time, have fun, learn heaps, and I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.